Before I moved to Toledo, I had ascribed it flyover status before I had ever even heard the phrase. I had an adventurous journey across the pond in my past and ambitions of great things in my future. For me, Toledo was supposed to be a stepping stone before moving on to somewhere new. But what started as a 3-month contract has turned into 3 years here, and perhaps into forever. Not because I got stuck here, but because the lives and stories I found here are worth sticking around for. I'm Caitlin Cooper, a community fellow at Midstory, and I'll be your host today. For the first 7 weeks of our show, you heard the story of Samuel Chang, one of our founders, and how his journey led him first to Toledo, then the East Coast, and then back to Toledo. Now, you'll be hearing from some other members of the Midstory team. We'll be sharing our histories, what brought us to Toledo, and what we found in the Glass City. Truth be told, I hadn't heard of Toledo before I moved here. I was born and raised in a seaside town in the southeast of England. In my late teens, I moved to London, where I thrived in the excitement of the big city. The move fueled my big dreams of exploration and independence. So, when my university offered me the opportunity to study abroad in America, I grabbed it with both hands. But by the time my brief exchange semester was up, I was desperate for more. I ambitiously applied for a scholarship to complete a master's degree at the University of Pennsylvania, and I never looked back. My journey across the pond from England kept me mostly on the East Coast, in cities like Philadelphia and New York that mirrored the hustle and bustle of London that I was used to. In my early 20s, I envisioned a life trying on new urban cities like outfits in a store, finding the lifestyle that best fit me. A move to Ohio just didn't seem in the cards. But the same adventurous spirit that brought me here also kept me open-minded. So, when the opportunity to work with Midstory arose, I jumped at it. Though I considered Toledo itself a temporary pit stop, I viewed the work with Midstory as far more meaningful. My English degrees imbued in me a passion for storytelling. And with Midstory, I could pair this with my love for place, whatever that place may be. What I found when I got here was more than just a meaningful career. It was, in many ways, a life-changing experience. I found a different way of living than the individualistic ambition that drives big cities. Instead, the driving force here is community. Toledoans have the spirit for investing not in the what's next, but in the place they inhabit and in the people they surround themselves with day in and day out. Learning and writing about this region's stories, spirit, and integrity continually inspires me. In Toledo, I found a more fulfilling way of life than any I had tried on before. I discovered the transformative power of place for myself. And in this hour, I hope to share a glimpse of that with you. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. This week, we're featuring stories about moving forward. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home. And likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the final episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, a podcast produced by Reckoning Inc. in collaboration with Ohio Humanities. The Copperhead Conspiracy tells a little-known story from the Civil War about a treasonous Midwestern plot to bring down the Union. Next up, the story of how a new kind of plane is taking off in the birthplace of aviation. Finally, you'll hear about what's causing the biotechnology industry to boom in some of Ohio's largest cities. If you enjoy this program, be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. Throughout the Civil War, the Confederates and their northern sympathizers, known as the Copperheads, had devised a series of complicated plots against the Union. In the end, however, It was a simple plan that led to the assassination of President Lincoln. But what followed this act was anything but simple. Many questions arose, some of which are still being answered today. Had John Wilkes Booth acted alone? How did Lincoln, a deeply unpopular president among many, deserve to be remembered? And how would the Copperheads go down in history? As harmless opponents of Lincoln or as traitors to the Union? Here is Aftermath, the sixth and final episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, an Ohio Humanities and Reckoning Inc. podcast.
Welcome to the final episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy. I'm Dan Gettiman. Most Americans know what happened at Washington's Ford Theater on April 14, 1865. During a performance of the play Our American Cousin, John Wilkes Booth fired a single shot into the head of President Abraham Lincoln, mortally wounding him, though he wouldn't die until the early morning hours of the following day. After firing his derringer, Booth jumped from the balcony down to the stage of the theater, injuring his leg before escaping through a back door and jumping on a horse. After a multi-state manhunt that lasted 12 days, Booth was caught in a Virginia barn where he was shot and killed. In the aftermath, several of Booth's co-conspirators were arrested, tried, and hanged for their part in the plot. Those are the facts that most people agree on. And yet, for over 160 years, an untold number of books, dissertations, and articles have been written on the subject, examining it from every possible angle. For many scholars who have looked at the events covered in this series, one of the most vexing questions is whether and how to explore the possible connections between the Confederate government and those who participated in the Lincoln assassination plot. The problem is a lack of documentary evidence, a smoking gun, if you wish, that clearly makes this connection. But sometimes, as in the case of the Watergate scandal, it's easier to identify the evidence of a cover-up than of the crime itself. And that indeed seems to be the case here. A purposeful campaign to redirect attention away from the Confederacy began shortly after the assassination, when the U.S. government issued arrest warrants with large cash rewards for several Confederate leaders whom they believed had a role in the assassination. Journalist and author Julian Schur.
So about a month after the assassination, the new administration issues a kind of indictment, a conspiracy indictment, saying that Booth was just part of a wider conspiracy. And five of the six people they name are all in Canada. The only person not in Canada is Jefferson Davis, who, by the way, will eventually end up in Canada.
In addition to Davis, the arrest warrant named Confederate commissioners Jacob Thompson and Clement Clay, William Cleary, who served as a secretary to Clement Clay, Beverly Tucker, who procured supplies for the Confederate Army, and an enigmatic Kentuckian named George Sanders, who had no official title, and yet was a force behind the scenes in the Confederacy for several years.
Sanders grew up in the South, a fairly prosperous family, worms himself into Confederate circles, and prior to the war, actually gets named as the U.S. ambassador to London, but gets into trouble because he openly talks in London about the righteousness of assassinating tyrants. Words, of course, that will take on a lot more meaning during the Civil War. He is recalled. And when the Civil War breaks out, he openly decides to work for the South and makes his way to Southern Ontario near Niagara Falls and establishes himself there as his second home. He becomes one of the main Confederate agents. George Sanders is the one who will help finance and raise the money to defend the Vermont raiders. George Sanders also will meet with John Wilkes Booth when Booth comes here for 2 weeks in the fall of 1864. We know from eyewitness testimony the two of them meet and they're whispering in corners. We don't know what they talk about. Did Booth talk to Sanders about his idea of kidnapping Lincoln. That was Booth's idea at the time. Did George Sanders talk to Booth about the validity of assassinating tyrants? We don't know. But at that time, Sanders is chatting with John Wilkes Booth, and he's approached by a well-known British journalist, and he utters these words where he says, "We are talking about things that will make the world shudder in a few months."
It has been said of the Civil War that while the North won the war, the South won the peace. One of the ways this manifested itself was that former Confederates were largely successful in revising the narrative of the Civil War, especially removing the preservation of slavery as a primary goal of the South seceding from the United States. But another part of history they successfully rewrote was the assassination of Lincoln, away from any possible involvement of Confederate leaders and toward a lone gunman scenario, with no assistance for the assassin either before or after the shooting from any Confederate operative. And no one was more responsible for this than George Sanders.
The Confederate agents in Canada and the Confederate supporters all through the South obviously had a dilemma on their hand, because with the assassination of Lincoln, on the one hand, it was their wish come true, right? I mean, he was evil incarnate. That, you know, I'm sure most of them must have been thrilled that their chief enemy had been assassinated. But like almost all conspiracies, the people involved, one way or the other, have to try to deflect the blame. George Sanders is named in the indictment as one of the conspirators. He, of course, claims his innocence, but then, being the conspirator, he hatches this wonderful plot, and he starts writing letters and documents that will be first published in Canadian papers and then spread all through the United States, where he says that Andrew Johnson, the vice president, would have been the person behind the plot. And that has been a story that has reverberated to this day.
George Sanders then engineered yet another coup of misdirection.
In the wake of Lincoln's assassination, the nation, of course, is reeling in horror and shock. And there are these massive conspiracy trials against the assassins. But the prosecutors wanted to try to widen the attack and try to accuse Jefferson Davis and several of the leaders in Canada as direct conspirators. And there were several witnesses, Union spies, Confederate agents, who gave quite gripping testimony. They testified that Jacob Thompson, the head of the Confederate Secret Service in Canada, knew about the assassination, was plotting, was part of the plot, had meetings with Booth, and it went on and on and on. And it looked like, you know, they tied it up in a bow. This was amazing. What was later uncovered is that George Sanders, that wonderful manipulator, had in fact conspired and plotted with at least one of the witnesses to give knowingly false evidence. In fact, if you look at some of the evidence, it could not have been true, because he had claimed that John Wilkes Booth had met with Jacob Thompson when it physically wasn't possible. Jacob Thompson was not in the same city. There were other problems, letters that were claimed to have been sent that just had the wrong dates. The testimony was shoddy, but the prosecutors and frankly the political establishment were so keen to try to nail Jefferson Davis and the Confederate leaders with responsibility that they used these witnesses, and it blows up in their face. Now, politically, I think it's undeniable that Jefferson Davis and the other leaders played a role in the assassination, because they created the atmosphere, and in fact, they engaged and supported other plots against Lincoln. But legally, in a court of law, you are never going to prove that Jefferson Davis and Jacob Thompson and the Confederate agents in Canada directly conspired with John Wilkes Booth.
One person who definitely did conspire with John Wilkes Booth was John Surratt. And unlike his other co-conspirators, he faced few consequences for his involvement in the plot, although his mother Mary was one of the four people who were executed for the assassination. On April 14th, he was in Elmira, New York, on an unrelated mission for the Confederate Secret Service. When he learned of the assassination, he immediately crossed the border to Canada to evade capture by Union soldiers. While there, he got considerable help from a network of Catholic priests.
The Catholic Church in Quebec was very conservative, very traditional, and for a variety of reasons, sympathized with the South. Not necessarily because they supported slavery, but they certainly liked the class structure, the aristocracy in the South. They saw the South as this beleaguered minority. So Confederate agents had top alliances with senior church leaders. And thanks to those church leaders, Surratt is secreted out of Montreal and by boat lands up in a small village on the outskirts of the city called Saint-Liboire, where a sympathetic priest called Father Lapierre will hide him in his house for quite a long time.
For the next several months, a network of Canadian Catholics moved Surratt around the eastern part of Canada to avoid capture, eventually deciding to send him to Italy.
Thanks to letters they write, he gets a posting as a zouave, which was the Pope's army in Italy. That's where he's sent. He hides out again for another year, thanks to the Catholic Church, is discovered there, brought back for trial in 1867. His trial is a civil trial, not a military trial like his mother and the other conspirators faced. And he gets acquitted by a jury of his peers.
We know what happened to John Surratt, to John Wilkes Booth, and to the four assassination conspirators who were executed. But what happened after the Civil War to the Confederate and Copperhead leaders who participated in these conspiracies? The short answer, just about nothing. A few of them served a bit of prison time near the end of the war. Others were exiled, most of them settling in Canada. But when President Andrew Johnson issued an amnesty for former Confederates willing to take a loyalty oath, most were able to return home. And after that, by and large, they all ended up falling upward. They became lawyers, judges, businessmen, senators, and congressmen. Confederate spy Thomas Hines became the Chief Justice of the Appellate Court in Kentucky. One Copperhead leader, Thomas Hendricks, even became Vice President of the United States under Grover Cleveland. And then there's Luke Blackburn, the guy who tried to start a yellow fever epidemic.
Blackburn is put on trial. You can imagine the headlines in the New York papers, terror plot, you know, evil doctor. The case is largely thrown out. On a technicality, the Americans are apoplectic. Dr. Luke Blackburn, openly boasting about being the man behind the yellow fever plot, after he's put on trial and acquitted, makes his way to Kentucky, his home state, after the war, and he runs to become governor in 1879. So the Northern papers, seeing that this man was now running for governor, they're aghast at it. They called him the hideous devil behind the black vomit scare, and they ran exposés. And again, in echoes of what we see today, Blackburn literally shrugs off the stories about him being involved in the yellow fever plot. He says those are too preposterous for intelligent gentlemen to believe. Blackburn gets elected, will actually become one of the most popular governors of Kentucky for 4 years until 1883.
When I first learned of this story, while researching another series, The Reckoning, the main thing I wondered was, why had I never heard about this before? How could such a consequential chapter in American history have become so obscure that most of the relevant books on the subject are long out of print, most having been written 75 or more years ago. And many of those that were written in recent decades largely dismissed the story as some combination of paranoid delusion and anti-democratic party propaganda. But early in the 21st century, a new generation of scholars started looking at this period with fresh eyes and came to very different conclusions. One of the first to do so was historian Jennifer Weber. I asked her why the story of the Copperhead Movement had largely disappeared.
There was a historian who really started making his mark in the early 1960s named Frank Clement. And he was adamant that there was nothing nefarious going on with the Copperheads, that they had no interest in overthrowing the government, that this was an understandable dissenting movement that never posed any serious threat to the United States. And he was persuasive enough that historians just then let that go and didn't talk about the Copperheads really and didn't examine them. They would show up in a few paragraphs maybe of a book on the Civil War, but they didn't really have any deep examination for decades.
At the close of every interview I conducted for this series, I asked the same question. Why is understanding this part of American history at all important? Especially since most of what the Copperheads tried to accomplish in terms of violent revolution never came to pass, largely because of the efforts of Union spies. And how might these events from the 1860s be at all relevant to the times we live in today? I started by asking Patrick Lewis, the director of the Filson Historical Society in Louisville.
What this has led to in retrospect is an ongoing historical conversation that has lasted for over 100 years now among scholars who have looked back at these anti-governmental efforts and said, how real was this? Was this all just overblown conspiracy? Or was this actually real? And I think there's always an overpromising of these kind of terroristic groups. But as we can attest from our own day and time, they can also present a real danger to a civil government. You know, the institutions of American democracy are not as solid as we all hope they would be. And there are some fragile points that a well-committed and organized group of anti-governmental, you know, treasonous actors can really target and bring down a government in peacetime, but especially in war.
You can't hide the past. The past is with us, continues to live with us. And if we don't recognize the truth of the past, then we're not going to understand the truth of today. And let me give you a very concrete example. In the wake of the Civil War, a group is formed called the United Daughters of the Confederacy in the 1890s, with the deliberate attempt to make sure that schools and churches and in the public mind, the history of the Civil War would not see the South as slave owners. They literally wrote guidebooks, and I'm quoting, they literally said, reject any book that says the South fought to hold her slaves. Reject a book that speaks of the slaveholder of the South as cruel and unjust to his slaves. This is important because everything we've been talking about, you know, it's not just who wins the war, but who wins the history of the war. In Florida today, there are new mandates for how you teach history. And this is a literal quote from the guideline that they're putting out for books in Florida today. It says, in addition to agricultural work, enslaved people learned specialized trades and worked as painters, carpenters, tailors, musicians, and healers in the North and South. Once free, African Americans used these skills to provide for themselves and others. That's the lost cause. We have politicians today forcing schools to rewrite the history the same way Confederate sympathizers did in the 1890s.
So often the story that we tell as a nation is a binary story. And from a Northern perspective, it's often told that the North was good and the North fought to end slavery, and that the South was bad and fought to preserve slavery. And that just leads Southerners to not wrongly have a chip on their shoulder, that somehow the racial sins of the nation are all laid at their feet and that the Northerners get off scot-free. So I find it really important to talk about how terrified white Northerners were at the idea that free Black people were going to be coming across the river, because it helps us understand that the North was not fighting to end slavery as an initial war aim. And even at the end of the war, just because they were fighting to end slavery didn't mean they were fighting for racial equality. And that sets us up to understand the lasting impact of racial tensions and racial violence for the next 160 years. We continue to see this today. The idea that the Civil War in some way solved the racial problem of the United States, or that following the Civil War, Black people had freedom and what more should they want? And that somehow assisting Black people who had been enslaved and ended slavery with nothing, that that's a handout. If there's still a wealth inequality today, that's their own fault. It's not the fault of any of the structures that existed pre-Civil War, during the war, and after.
It's a really tricky thing to telescope the past to the present. But in this case, it's instructive, because what we see in this moment are some of the same political divisions, particularly in the Midwest right now, that we saw in 1861 to 1865 and beyond. What I found is that the political divisions that divided Republicans from peace Democrats or Copperheads became the foundation for the post-war politics within these states between Democrats and Republicans, that found them contesting election after election by using and reopening war wounds. And in many ways, those kinds of divisions will persist in a place that unfortunately we've interpreted as being all for the Union. But within these states themselves, there was this kind of perpetual tension and an outright strife about the future of the nation. Even the word Midwest kind of comes out of a recognition that this old Northwest is a place of two lives. Lives of small towns that are supposed to be progressive and middle class and kind of stable and bucolic. And then you've got this, the rest of the Midwest, a Midwest of sundown towns, a Midwest of racial animosity and lynchings, a dark place. It's a Midwest that unfortunately right now has shown that darker side in ascendance.
In my opinion, the importance of understanding history is at least twofold. Number one is to understand the complex nature of the United States in all its good points and not so good points. It's important to know the entire story. The second point is, if folks don't learn about history, it's not like that history repeats itself, but it does repeat itself. So you want to understand history because you have these themes that reoccur. And so understanding that history is that nothing new happens under the sun. It's the same old, same old. The question is, we haven't learned from our past, so we don't do better. It's like my grandmother says, you do better when you know better.
Those were historians Patrick Lewis, Julian Schur, Shannon Smith, Chris Phillips, and Eric Jackson. There are many reasons to find the events outlined in this series to be worth studying 160 years after the fact. Consider what could happen if a president today suspended our basic civil liberties, as Lincoln did during the 1860s. Would Congress allow that? What about the Supreme Court? What kind of backlash might occur, perhaps violent in nature, among the citizens? And what type of spiral toward dictatorship could that backlash lead to? The story of the Copperheads during the Civil War is, in many respects, a cautionary tale, with lessons for all of us to think about and perhaps to learn from. The Copperhead Conspiracy is a production of Reckoning, Inc., with funding and scholarly assistance from Ohio Humanities. It was produced and narrated by me, Dan Gediman. Our historical consultant was Dr. Stephen Rockenbach. Voice actors were Alec Voles and Barrett Cooper. Our theme music was composed by Jacori Arthur, with other music licensed from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Nina Ellis, Louisville Public Media, and to Loretta Williams for editorial guidance. Major support for this series was provided by Archon Construction. Additional support from Jay and Susan Giles, Doreen Yuha Sauer, Lopa Mehrotra, and Douglas and Marissa Brown. Many thanks to Julian Schur, Jennifer Weber, Patrick Lewis, Shannon Smith, Chris Phillips, and Eric Jackson, whose interviews were heard in this episode. Please note that the views expressed by Jennifer Weber do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force Academy, the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. If you would like to support our nonprofit organization and unlock bonus episodes of this series, you can do so at patreon.com/reckoningradio. Our first bonus episode explains all the key events in American history that led to the Civil War. You can access that and more at patreon.com/reckoningradio. For transcripts, a bibliography, and other content related to this series, please visit our website at copperheadconspiracy.org. That's copperheadconspiracy.org. And if you haven't already done so, please leave a review of this series on whatever platform you use to hear it. It will really help other listeners to find this podcast. And finally, if you'd like to hear another series we've produced on a related subject, please seek out The Reckoning, Facing the Legacy of Slavery in America. You can find it at reckoningradio.org/podcast. That's reckoningradio.org/podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.
If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the Midstory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org or wgte.org, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Midwest is farm country. Infinite horizons of corn and soybeans tilled by grizzled farmers on their green John Deere tractors. At least, that's what we've been told to believe about the region. But that stereotype sells us woefully short on the Midwest's $150 billion economic engine, a true powerhouse in the nation's heartland.
The ag industry is one of the best kept secrets.
Farmers for many years haven't really shared their story of what they do and how they're passionate about it.
But the region's farms are facing big challenges.
Soil erosion is causing serious problems for farmers all across the Midwest.
Scientists believe America's breadbasket could soon be empty, and they're warning a relentless drought is harming the nation's wheat crops.
Historic flooding damaging farming communities and raising fears that food prices could climb.
Sometimes the industry only has itself to blame. Farming practices have eroded soils and polluted waterways, inflicting serious damage on the environment. Big Ag is responsible for 10% of America's greenhouse gas emissions, and warming temperatures and extreme weather have wreaked havoc on the growing season. But the field is also full of people striving to find a better way forward. There are champions of soil and water management innovators in cutting-edge technologies, advocates for social and economic justice, and even everyday people turning back to the land to find purpose in tumultuous times.
You can still do business with a handshake.
My word is my bond. And that's why I love ag so much.
It's our natural instinct to feel like we're stewards of the land. You can't go out and make new land at any time. So whatever we have as an industry, we feel that we've got to keep.
The Midwestern farmer is so productive. There was really no stopping them in terms of what they could do.
The grass certainly looks greener on the far side of this crisis. But how do we get there? And what could the farm and the farmer of tomorrow look like? I'm Yannick Schaller, and this is Greener Pastures, a brand new mid-story podcast on the future of farming in the Midwest. Not everyone shares the same vision of what's to come, but the conversation about what ag has gotten wrong and what it still can get very, very right, maybe it should start with the farmers themselves. Isn't it time we started listening to what they have to say? The Midwest as you've never seen it, farming as you've never known it, and what a fresh understanding of land, water, and food could hold for us all. Tune in to episode 1 of Greener Pastures on midstory.org, WGTE, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ohio is often called the birthplace of aviation, thanks to the famous Dayton-based Wright brothers. But the state's link to flight goes far beyond that. Today, the Dayton-Springfield area is home to a burgeoning electric aircraft industry. Companies and nonprofits are investing in the area, hoping to build a new generation of talent in the Miami Valley. Though electric planes are much smaller than their traditional counterparts, they offer their own benefits, and supporters hope they will change how we think about short-distance travel. I had the chance to talk to Celia Johnson, one of our fellows, about the past, present, and future of Ohio's aviation industry. Here's that conversation now. So, Celia, you wrote this piece about electric aviation. What got you interested in that story?
Well, I'm very interested in the environment, and I know that planes contribute a lot to our emissions because you need to use a lot of fuel to fly a plane, obviously. And one great way to reduce a lot of emissions would be to be able to have an electric plane, like an electric car that runs, you know, on a battery instead of with fuel.
Right. Interesting. And kind of the main point of this story is that it's all happening here in Ohio, which is kind of an unlikely place, you might think. But I guess it's not, because we kind of know Ohio's history with flight, right? Can you talk to me about the history?
Yeah, that was another aspect that got me interested in this piece and seeing specifically what the history of flight and the present of flight looks like in Ohio. So obviously, the Wright brothers flew for the first time in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, but they chose that because there were good sand dunes there. In reality, they were from Dayton. They did most of their work in a workshop there. So that's the biggest connection that Ohio has to the history of flight, I would say. But then the state also has a long history with our astronaut program. So a number of astronauts have come from Ohio. And actually, in Toledo, this type of fabric called beta cloth was invented, and beta cloth is what they make astronaut suits out of. So there's another fun connection between flight and Ohio.
Yeah. And so what is happening now with electric aviation in Ohio?
Yeah. So actually, there's a number of initiatives going on to support electric aviation in Ohio. They're mainly happening in the Miami Valley area, which is includes Dayton, where the Wright brothers are from. So one of the big ones is that an electric aviation company named Joby is building a factory there, and that will be their first full-scale factory to produce electric planes there. And then there's a couple of other initiatives supporting electric planes in the area.
And is this a new thing? When was the first electric plane kind of thought about?
I think people have been thinking about electric planes for a long time, and I would say that the process has been pretty gradual, honestly. But it does seem like they may be reaching the finishing stages now. I think it's hard to say, There's still no plane that's approved for commercial use in the United States, but I know Joby, another company named Beta, they're announcing partnerships with places like Uber, and I know that they're trying to offer like air taxi services, probably starting in the Middle East is where it seems like that's going to start. So they're hoping to launch those services in, you know, the next year or two, which would be a pretty big step forward for electric planes.
Wow. And so how does it actually work?
Yeah, so like I said, like an electric car, they use a battery instead of fuel. So they're rechargeable. You need charging stations. And then there's two types of electric airplanes, roughly. One is an eCTOL and one is an eVTOL. The E stands for electric. The TOL stands for takeoff and landing. And then the C and the V are conventional and vertical. So an eCTOL needs to use a runway, like a regular plane. So it's a conventional plane, but a vertical takeoff and landing plane can go up and down like a helicopter. And there are some electric planes that are capable of both conventional takeoff and vertical takeoff. And my interviewees explained to me that vertical takeoff is a really big boon because then you can use things like helipads. There's a lot more helipads in the US than there are airports. And if we're thinking about electric planes making short haul flights, you know, in cities, in like dense areas, it's obviously much more efficient to use helipads and to try to go from airport to airport.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to fly an electric plane?
Yeah, so I spoke to Tyler Prather, who flies for Beta. She's a human factors engineer at Beta, but she also got to fly for them in a recent race, which I think we'll talk about later. And she said that it's very similar to flying a regular airplane. She was trained to fly on a conventional jet-powered airplane, but the big difference is that it's really quiet. And you notice that, I think, not just when you're flying, but spectators notice it too. So people said to me that, you know, you don't even notice when it's taking off and landing, which can be kind of a scary experience.
Wow, because, I can't even imagine that.
Right. A jet-powered plane, everyone in the vicinity knows what's happening.
Right.
It's very different.
Yeah. So thinking about, like, the aviation industry as a whole, which is obviously all we know is jet-powered planes, what are the advantages of this new electric aviation?
Yeah, I think number one is the environmentally friendly qualities, like I mentioned at the beginning of the piece. Obviously, the electric grid does still use fossil fuels and things like that. So it's not a completely clean way to fly planes, but it's much cleaner than using fossil fuel directly. I guess another advantage is that quiet factor that I mentioned, right? They're not disruptive to local communities, as opposed to you really don't want to live next to an airport, right?
Right. It's a pretty unpleasant experience. No one wants to live near an airport. And do you foresee any disadvantages?
Yeah. So to battery power a normal-sized passenger plane, you'd have to have a giant battery and would make the plane incredibly heavy. And so electric planes right now are pretty small. They're more like helicopter size. They only can fit a couple of people. And then because when you're thinking about electric cars, right, if you want to road trip through rural Alaska, you might be pretty worried about the absence of chargers there. And that's the same problem with electric planes because they need to be recharged. You need to be thinking about creating these routes that link up chargers. Obviously, that can be solved by building a more robust network of electric plane chargers. But for now, that's definitely a disadvantage on how far they can fly.
Yeah. So we're really thinking about like the different ways that we could maybe use air travel or flights. So what might electric planes be used for in the future?
Yeah, I think because of their small size right now, they're definitely not going to be viable for flying a whole plane load of people from the US to the UK maybe. But for short haul flights, maybe 50, 60 miles, somewhere you might want to go in a car, but would be kind of inconvenient to go in a car, electric planes could be really convenient. And then another use that was suggested to me would be like medical life flights. So if you need to fly an organ from one hospital to another in a city, like I mentioned with those eVTOL, the electric plane can lift off a helipad in one hospital, land on the helipad of another hospital, very quick, very efficient.
Mm-hmm. And with Ohio kind of being a hub for these facilities that are coming up in this industry, is the state doing anything to support these developments?
Definitely. So the Joby facility that I mentioned, which opened in October, I believe, of last year, the state gave them a $93 million tax credit for building that facility. And another initiative in the state, which was partially funded by the U.S. Department of Defense and by the city of Springfield, is NAMCE, which is the National Advanced Air Mobility Center of Excellence. And that's a center that's dedicated to helping advanced air mobility, which is a broader category, which includes things like drones, but also includes electric airplanes. Their sole aim is to help the industry get to commercial status. And so they have physical space at the Springfield-Beckley Municipal Airport, and they rent out space to tenants like Joby and like Beta, the other company I mentioned. And I spoke to their executive director, Ted Angel, and he said that, you know, one of the big benefits is just having everyone in that same area. They're all able to collaborate, even if they are competitors. But because there's a wide range of tenants who do different things within the aviation industry, they are able to collaborate with each other.
Right. So in this up-and-coming industry, we have private companies, we have the state kind of giving these incentives. How are people getting involved? Do the people know about this? Are they getting excited?
Yeah, I feel like electric aviation is still kind of flying under the radar. I mean, would you say that you had heard about this before?
No,
this?
I absolutely had not.
Yeah, I think people know that, and supporters of the industry really want to help bring it to a wider audience. And a lot of people compared it to, you know, in the 1920s, right after the Wright brothers flew, people also didn't know much about regular airplanes, right? And they were kind of scary. And so what happened was there started to be these air shows and air races all around the country with the aim of promoting planes to people, showing people they were cool, they were, you know, safe, and they were going to be a technology that would transform our lives, because that really wasn't certain, I think, from the beginning. And so people who are supporting the electric aviation industry also want that to happen. And one thing that they did was they revived one of these races from the 1920s called the Pulitzer Cup. And the first new Pulitzer Cup for all electric planes was hosted by NAMC at Springfield-Beckley Airport last year. And it featured a number of electric planes. They flew this triangular course. And it was just to see who could be the fastest and to show that electric airplanes are capable of flying a good distance, of flying fast, and of being a technology that's going to be really important in the future. And then they also had an exhibition in the hangar, I believe, as well. So that was just people from the community could come out and see the planes. And this is, you know, where people were mentioning to me that it's so quiet. Like, they had to warn people when the planes were taking off because people wouldn't even notice. And at the exhibition, they actually had a replica of a Wright brothers plane in the hangar, which I thought was really cool because, you know, bringing together the past and maybe the future of aviation in one place.
I love that. So with this rise of electric aviation, history is kind of repeating itself in the best way, and especially doing it right here in Ohio.
Yeah, hopefully Ohio will have a big role to play in aviation going forward.
Awesome. Thank you, Celia.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mark your calendars for Saturday, April 11th for the largest regional pickleball tournament held at the University of Toledo, the Toledo Pickleball Classic and Career Futures Expo. The event is free and open to the public and will feature tournaments across corporate teams, UToledo student orgs, and local high schoolers, a Career Futures Expo with 80-plus companies looking for the next round of talent, and a community carnival with bouncy houses, a free kids pickleball clinic, food trucks, and more. Visit ToledoPickleballClassic.org for more info.
Biotechnology is a vitally important industry to our world today. In the United States, the industry has historically been located on the coasts, but that may be changing. In Ohio, Cincinnati and Columbus especially boast growing biotech industries, a strong talent pool, world-class healthcare facilities, and relatively low operating costs have helped these cities distinguish themselves in the field. Going forward, biotech industry groups in the state hope that initiatives showcasing the industry will attract more investors and bring continued success. Midstory intern Kieran Hubbard investigated what's behind Ohio's biotech boom and what it would take to truly make the state a national biotechnology hub. She chats with fellow Celia Johnson about her findings.
So, Kieran, thanks so much for joining us today. I know we're going to be talking about your story about the growth of biotechnology in Ohio. So let's start at the beginning of the story. What made you interested in writing about this?
Basically, I was kind of looking around at trends in Ohio specifically, and also just the Midwest in general. And I noticed something that was reporting on an increase in biotech industry in Ohio. So that report that was talking about the growing trend of biotech cited this list compiled by CBRE, which stated that Columbus and Cincinnati were two cities that received over $560 million from the National Institutes of Health for life sciences funding. And I just thought that was super interesting because Ohio had never really been something in the front of my mind when I first think of biotechnology, and I thought it was really worth looking into.
So, I mean, that's a big number, but we know people invest a lot of money in industries like these. When you're thinking about how these compare to other emerging biotech hubs, is that still a lot of money?
Yeah, so those two cities were actually the two highest receivers of funding in 2022 among life sciences hubs.
So let's give a little context to our listeners. What exactly is biotechnology?
Biotechnology is really a broad term that pretty much refers to any type of the use of life processes or biology to develop products that fix a problem. So that could be to improve human health or save lives. And most commonly, I think people think of drugs that are manufactured in this way as biotech.
And would that also include something like vaccines?
Yes, absolutely. The mRNA-based vaccines, especially for COVID, are probably one of the most well-known examples of a biotechnology product.
So you talked about this CBRE report was talking about emerging life sciences hubs. So where has the biotech industry historically been located?
So historically, biotech has been really concentrated in either of the coasts. So either Northern or Southern California, and especially Massachusetts and Boston, has really seen a lot of the focus on biotech.
And why have those places been so popular?
A lot of it is that they already have that reputation for being known for biotech, so that really draws more people in. So that's a big part of it. And it's also just because they have a lot of those big cities that have a lot of research institutions that draw in this kind of development.
So I imagine it sounds kind of difficult to start biotech in a new place because that new place doesn't have that same reputation.
Yes, exactly.
Are there other factors that make it difficult to establish a new biotech hub?
Yes, something that kind of goes hand in hand with that reputation aspect is getting capital investment. So getting enough money and resources for biotech development is a really big hurdle in companies, especially startup companies, being able to kind of hit the ground running and really get their start. And it goes along with that reputational aspect, because if investors aren't sure that where you are is a really big place for biotech, they might be less sure about investing their money in your company.
And why is it important to have multiple biotech companies in one place, right? Like, why do we need these hubs as opposed to having a scattered industry?
So yeah, having these kind of centralized hubs of biotech can be really helpful because they're typically really close to research institutions like hospitals or universities. And this kind of helps draw in a talent pool. And that means that these companies have a lot of access to a workforce that is available and willing to work for these products.
So is there a talent pool in Ohio? Is that why some companies are choosing to establish their companies here, despite all the difficulties we just talked about?
Yes, absolutely. There's a talent pool here. A lot of it comes out of the research universities and places like Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus. So these have drawn in people from all over the country to come work on this research, and then that then makes them available to work for these biotech companies in Ohio.
And then another thing people talk about a lot with the Midwest is affordability. So you already said it can cost a lot of money to establish these companies. Is there an affordability advantage to being located in Ohio?
Yes, Ohio does have a lower cost of living than a lot of the really big cities on the coast. So this can also be a factor. And it's cost of living as well as actual construction costs for building the facilities that are necessary to do this kind of biotech research. So those also factor into starting these companies in this area.
It makes a lot of sense. So you talked a little bit about universities, hospitals that already exist to help boost the biotech industry in Ohio. Are there other groups trying to grow the industry beyond those big institutions?
Yes, absolutely. So there are also trade groups, and one example of those is Ohio Life Sciences, and they are really pulling to actively propel the biotech industry and kind of spread good press about the growth of the biotech industry in the area.
And what about, we talked about the talent pool. Obviously, some people are going to these prestigious research universities like Case Western, but other people might not have the ability to attend a full-pay university like that. Are there other options for people who are interested in biotechnology jobs?
Definitely. So one example of that would be Columbus State Community College hosts something called the Biotechnology Bootcamp. And this is basically a 12-week program that teaches people the skills they need to get into an entry-level biotech role. And again, this is just growing the available workforce and also increasing the opportunities for people to work in this sector.
So it sounds like it could be a boost to lots of everyday Ohioans to have this industry in the state.
Yes, absolutely.
And are there other positives that you see to growing the biotech industry here?
Yeah, as well as just the economic and the job growth factor. I think biotech in general is so important, and having it be a hub in this area means that there are places working towards improving people's lives and even saving people's lives. And these are products that really everyone can benefit from if they need them.
So where do you see the biotechnology industry going from here in Ohio?
I really think that the biotech industry will just continue to increase in Ohio, especially as some of these decades of research are paying off into actual products. I think there will continue to be more awareness spread about the growth of the industry, and that will just contribute to it increasing even more.
And hopefully that will be a boon for both the industry and for all of us here in Ohio.
Well, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us today, Kieran. Before we go, what's one thing we didn't cover that you want listeners to know?
Yeah, I would just say that even though we've talked a lot about the bigger cities in Ohio, that doesn't mean that other places aren't worth highlighting as well. So it's definitely worth keeping an eye on places like Springfield and Bowling Green and those smaller cities, because they also have the opportunity to be really big biotech areas. So something else that the Ohio Life Sciences has done is they partnered with Jobs Ohio to curate something called the Ohio Discovery Corridor. And this is basically a network connecting Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati to kind of encourage and stimulate the growth of STEM talent. So it can help places with everything from funding to actually finding talent and people to hire.
And it also includes some of those smaller cities, is that right?
Technically, these cities aren't in the corridor, but that doesn't mean that they're outside the reach of what the corridor is trying to accomplish.
So hopefully it will come to benefit all corners of the state.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Kieran. Super interesting conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Mid-Story Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Mid-Story, our home, and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share, or would just like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. The Midstory Hour is a Midstory podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Caitlin Cooper, written by Celia Johnson and Caitlin Cooper, and edited by Evan Blanco. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. This week's episode featured stories by the Greater Midstory team, including Celia Johnson, Kieran Hubbard, and Caitlin Cooper. Midstory is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018, by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Midstory re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.